You're listening to Bit by Bit, July 19th, 2008. Hello and welcome. This is Bob Sprankle with Bit by Bit, and we are heading back to the BLC 08 Building Learning Communities Conference with the Allen November Group in Newton, Massachusetts on July 18th, 2008 with Dr. Pedro Noguera's keynote. This is an incredible keynote. In fact, he got a standing ovation at the end, and I know you're going to enjoy this, and this is one that I'm going to have to listen to many, many times. Dr. Noguera talks a lot about culture in school and outside of school and how we have to attend to that as teachers. Dr. Noguera is a professor at the Steinhardt School of Education at New York University. He's a co-director of the Institute for the Study of Globalization and Education in Metropolitan Settings, and he's the director of the Metropolitan Center for Urban Education in New York, New York. So brings an incredible amount of experience and just an incredible talk. And thanks so much to him for letting me podcast this. So without further ado, back to July 18th, BLC 08 with Dr. Pedro Noguera.
Thinking, and I know Pedro will enjoy the follow-up session later of engaging with you as well. So without any more delay, it's my incredible privilege and honor to introduce to you Pedro, who was going to give a remarkable talk on school design. Isn't that right? Say yes. Yes. Yeah. I should mention, when I met Pedro, he was a professor at Harvard Ed School, migrated to NYU, as many Harvard professors seem to do these days. So he's left the Cambridge. Must be fun to come back, though.
It's great to come back.
Must be fun to come back. Okay.
Thanks, Alan. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here, and I want to thank Alan for inviting me and making it possible for me to be here with you this morning. I want to thank Apple. I'm going to start out by saying some things about Apple, because as I think about reimagining schools, it's often helpful to think about people who are reimagining technology all the time. And probably like many of you I see from the laptops in the audience, I'm also a Mac person, as you can see from my laptop here. And I was enthusiastic supporters out of the Mac. Listening to an interview with Steve Jobs talking about developing new technology. And one of the things he said that really struck me is that when they're developing a new product, they try not to look at existing products that are similar because they don't want to be encumbered by what's already there. They want to be able to imagine something new and think more in terms of the functions they're trying to create and then how to put it all together so that they can really create something that's innovative and novel and nothing like we've ever seen before. And those of you who live in Manhattan and saw those long lines for the new iPhone know that it seems to work, right? People really do take to this stuff. And I thought about that point when I was thinking about schools in this country and our need to reimagine schools and some of the difficulty involved in doing that. And I think much of the difficulty comes from the fact that the people charged with doing that work know schools as they are so well. Because we've worked in schools, we've gone to school, we have a sense of what school is supposed to be like, how it's supposed to function, and therefore our ability to reimagine, to re-envision it, to create new approaches to learning that really stimulate kids and tap into their intrinsic desire to learn is difficult. It's difficult because we are in many ways encumbered by what we already know. It's also difficult because what we already know is that many of our children in this country do not benefit from high-quality education right now. and ensuring that as we imagine a new future of education, one that educates all children, requires really think outside the box, because we've never done that before. We now have a law on the books which says there must be evidence that all children are learning. For all its faults, No Child Behind has taken us one big step forward. Because for the first time in this country's history, there is a requirement that all schools produce evidence that all children, without qualifier, special ed kids, homeless kids, recent immigrants, kids of all racial backgrounds, all children must learn. And what's interesting about that basic requirement is that many schools are struggling with it, and not just schools serving poor kids. In fact, I would argue that some of the schools that are the most challenged by No Child Behind and some of the schools that are the most angry with it are affluent schools and districts. And they're angry about a lot of things, and a lot of things about the law to be angry about. Okay? Any time we reduce the evidence of learning to a performance on a single test, well, that's enough to get a lot of people, myself included, pissed off. The idea that we're going to improve schools by humiliating them or putting them on a list somewhere and letting them know this is a failing school, I see very little evidence that that works. So that'll get me mad too. But the fact is that this law requires that we disaggregate the data. And when you disaggregate that data, well, lo and behold, even affluent districts with high per pupil spending, when you ask, well, how well are you doing with that small number of minority kids you've got, guess what? A whole lot of them aren't doing well at all. And No Child Behind pisses them off because they're exposed. And now they are held accountable for all their kids. And that's got a lot of them very uneasy. In fact, some of them want to find ways to get rid of some of those kids that bring their scores down now. And we can just change the way we draw the lines or find somebody else to take those kids. And I always say, you know, when you go to a school where people tell you, well, you know, we're really good if the kids come from affluent families and they're highly educated and they're motivated and they're prepared, we're really good with those kids. I said, well, you better be. Because those kids pretty much do it all on their own, don't they? In fact, we can only screw those kids up sometimes. Because so much of their learning is really due to their parents and due to the early learning opportunities that happen at home and happen when they're with their parents, traveling in the summer, over to the dinner table. The real measure of how good we are as educators and how good our schools are is how good are we with the kids who actually need help. With the kids who don't have two parents or fully engaged with lots of time on their hands. The families that are struggling to get by, that don't speak English. If I told you that there was a doctor out there who's very good, but only if you're healthy, you would say, I don't want that doctor. When I'm sick, I want a doctor who's good with sick people. Well, a lot of our schools are like the doctor who's only good with healthy people. And it shows in their data. Because whenever the kids are poor, whenever they're not white, whenever they're struggling, tends to be the school's struggle in serving their needs. And that struggle reinforces the idea that the problem is the kids. And I'm here to tell you today, the problem is not the kids. The problem is the way we treat the kids. The problem is the conditions we place kids under and the ways we limit kids based upon our inability to see their potential and to cultivate their talent. And if we can't imagine schools that can do that for all kids, then we're in trouble and deserve to be. We are now 25 years away from that major report called The Nation at Risk. Some of you remember that. 1984, nation's governors came together and said, we're a nation at risk from our mediocrity, headed by former Governor Bill Clinton. The report said that had another nation done to our schools what we've done ourselves, we declare war. because we had schools which this report claimed were holding our economy down, preventing us from being competitive, preventing us from leading the world into the 21st century. So now, 25 years later, where are we? Well, I would argue that there were a lot of problems with that report in the first place, okay, with what they diagnosed as being wrong. But I would also argue that to the degree they got it right, we haven't addressed many of the challenges that this country faces in public education. We have dropout rates across the country that hover over 50% in every major city in this country. If you read the Gates report, a silent epidemic, released 2 years ago, for the first time, truth in the dropout rate. And the truth is that if you don't measure it from the 12th grade, but from when the kids enter the 9th grade to how many exit in the 12th grade, lo and behold, many districts, and not just the big cities, even many suburban and rural districts have dropout rates over 50%. If you're losing that many kids, something fundamentally is wrong with what you're doing. And that's what's happening. We have these international comparisons that come out every year or two that show once again, the United States is lagging behind other countries. The TIMSS study, that's the study that compares us in math and science, came out 2 years ago, showed the United States was behind in math and science, behind Slovenia. That really pissed people off. Pissed the Congress off. Most of them didn't know Slovenia was even a country. How do we get behind Slovenia? South Korea, which previously didn't even rank, now way ahead of us. And every time those comparisons come out, we're behind, the politicians wring their hands and attack the schools, blame the teachers, but never ask, what are those countries doing that we're not doing? And you know what every single one of those countries does that's ahead of us? They have universal access to health care, universal access to preschool, parental leave. Guess what? Those things, those kinds of policies actually impact education. Sick kids don't do well in school. Good research on that now. Kids who have no stable housing and move a lot tend not to do so well either. We keep ignoring the fact that the conditions outside of school affect what happens within school. My colleague Gary Orfield, his wife, was an optometrist, did work in the Boston Public Schools, trying to figure out how much of the reading problem for children was actually caused by sight disorders. And lo and behold, over 15% of the kids who are struggling readers really just need eyeglasses. But there's no provision for in No Child Behind to make sure that kids who need it get eyeglasses or get their teeth fixed. The Canadians have shown us for years that if you address the basic needs of children, you can educate all children. And the Canadians are always within the top five in all those comparisons. They've also shown us you don't have to be afraid of learning another language and pass English-only laws. A lot of Canadians in the audience today. Those Canadians, they actually think kids can learn one more than a language. Even when they're 5 years old, they start them off real early. They don't wait till they're in high school. They start them off early. And they've shown us that you can produce bilingual children and produce schools that educate all people to a very high level of literacy and mathematical problem-solving ability and do it in an equitable manner. And Americans look and say, well, Canada's not like us. Norway's not like us. South Korea's not like us. So then I say, okay, well, what about Barbados? Are they anything like us? Oh, no. We're definitely better than Barbados, right? Well, guess what? Barbados has a higher adult literacy rate than the United States. Barbados, the average person, 98% of the peoples, have a reading level above the sixth grade. In this country, it's about 80% of adults. Barbados supports itself based on tourism, sugar cane. When I was there 5 years ago, they gave out the SAT to 300 students who wanted to go to college in the United States. The average SAT score for those 300 kids was over 1,200. That was the time when 1600 was the top score. And you should know this. All 300 kids who took the test were black and poor. Why is it that being poor and black is not an obstacle to achieving at high levels in Barbados? But it is here. We have a different problem in this country. And it's a problem that starts right away with our ability to attract good people into education. Because we continue to attract the bottom third of graduates into the teaching profession for the most part. We have many districts that have trouble retaining good teachers and administrators. New York City, where I live now, has to hire 6,000 teachers a year. But my friend Linda Darling Hammond likes to say, it's not because we have a shortage of teachers, we have a shortage of people willing to work in those schools. Lots of people with credentials out there, not so many willing to work in the South Bronx and other parts of the city. We have huge inequities in resources. We talk a lot about achievement gap, but what we really have in this country is an allocation gap. Because we consistently spend the most money on the most affluent children and the least money on the poorest children. And anybody who tells you that money doesn't matter usually has a lot of money, doesn't it? Never hear anybody who's poor say money doesn't matter. Only people say money doesn't matter, people have lots of it. No, money doesn't matter. Money's not the issue. Because we know that money translates into your ability to attract teachers and pay them a good salary, your ability to create good facilities and to create good learning environments. We have, in the midst of this recession that we're in now, districts that are cutting vital services and programs for children. And then finally, we've got these policy debates that are overly politicized, overly drawn out, and ideological, that keep us from doing what we know needs to be done. We keep focusing on silver bullet solutions when the basic ingredients of change get overlooked. We're faced with huge challenges in this country. I'll name just a few. Changing demographics due to immigration, and again, we're not the only one. Most of Western Europe, most of Asia experiencing very significant changes in demographics. Promise in this country, in a nation of immigrants, that we are, we have a tremendous backlash now against immigration. Even though our economy is dependent upon immigrant labor, we have communities that are passing laws that make it extremely difficult for the people who do the work to keep this country going to live and send their kids to school. When you treat people like fugitives, you make it harder for their children to get a good education. If their children don't get a good education, what we end up with is a permanent underclass. Latinos in this country, the fastest growing ethnic group in this country, have the highest employment rates of any group and the highest poverty rates. Why? Because Latinos are disproportionately stuck in the lowest wage jobs. And if they're recent immigrants, it's typically the jobs Americans won't do. Just ask those cannery workers in New Bedford, Mass. Because they did INS raids to try and get them out, get all those immigrant and those undocumented workers out, and then realized they just shut down the cannery business because nobody else wanted to work with fish heads. We have an illogical debate about immigration in this country today that's not based upon our national interest. We have persistent gaps in achievement, gaps that have been so persistent and so entrenched that it reinforces this idea that certain kids, because of their backgrounds, because of their race and color and culture, simply cannot achieve. And the reason why it does that is because we have a history of believing that to be the case. And that gap in achievement also undermines support for public education. So the public is growing increasingly restless and concerned about our ability to educate all children, and so public support for public education is at risk. And anyone who doesn't get it is not paying attention, because throughout the country, the call for vouchers, the call for homeschooling is growing. just a matter of time before the system of public education, if we know it, will be dismantled. And some of us might say, well, that's a good thing. It needs to be dismantled. But I know of no other institution right now that will take every child. Because despite its faults, and I could go on a long list of faults with respect to public education, there is no other institution in this country that accepts all children. Even the undocumented, the homeless, all children in this country have the right to a public education. Not an equal one, not even a good one, but the right to an education nonetheless. And if we allow that system, that institution, to be undermined further, or to be dismantled, I think our whole democracy is in peril. We've gone through a generation of reform. Most people trace the start of this to the Russian launch of Sputnik. Right? We were worried the Russians got there first. We wanted to catch them. Seymour Saracen, psychologist at Yale University, wrote a book in 1972 called The Culture of Change, The Problem of Reform and the Culture of Change. Let me say that again. The Problem of Change, no. The Culture of Schools and the Problem of Change. Forgive me, Seymour. The point of the book was this. I want to know, why was it, after all this work on reforming our schools, changing curriculum, changing textbooks, remember President Kennedy's physical fitness program? Why didn't we catch the Russians? Why didn't we catch Slovenia? Well, they weren't even in existence. Saracen said then, and I think it's still true now, he said the problem was we thought of reform as being like following a recipe in a cookbook. If you just mix the ingredients, voila, you will have great schools. Just do what they did in Kansas. Just do what they did in Omaha and bring it to your local school and you too will have great results. And what we consistently overlook is the fact that every school has a distinct culture. And if you can't change the beliefs, the attitudes, the expectations, the relationships within that school, nothing changes. But we keep pursuing reforms and we keep spending billions of dollars on the name of reform, typically top-down reforms, typically reforms that are not evaluated, that are not studied. Get a new governor, new reforms. New superintendent, new reforms. New principal, new reforms. Some of the most cynical people out there about reform are teachers, aren't they? Why are teachers so often cynical about reform? Because more often than not, reform is done to them, not with them. They're the subjects of reform, or the objects of it, not the subjects. And most of the time, we don't even stop to study and ask, what are we doing right? Why don't we just do more of what works and less of what doesn't? But that seems a little too common sense, huh? My father, who was a cop for 27 years in New York City, liked to say that common sense really wasn't that common. In public education, that's certainly the case. Because so much of what happens in the name of reform is not clearly making things better. Because we keep thinking there's this one thing we'll do. Just make schools charters. Just do more testing. Just change the fines. Every year you get a new idea, and sometimes the presidents, the candidates for public office, they run on it. They ran on phonics last time. And we know that whenever that happens, the basic ingredients of quality education get ignored because it's never one thing. It's always that combination of things. Good teaching, good leadership, parental support, student engagement. If you can't get those things to happen, it's hard to create the schools we need. And we don't get that through a quick fix either, or through some silver bullet. So I encourage you to start thinking while you're here at this conference about your school, about the attitudes, beliefs, the norms, the values, the culture of your school, because ultimately, if that doesn't change, our ability to create the schools we imagine, the schools that we need, will be extremely limited, if not impossible. Now, there is some good news out there. And I get to travel across the country visiting schools and working with educators, so I get to see a lot of the signs of good news in practice. And there are now large urban districts, I'll just give you two, Atlanta and Miami, that are showing you can achieve real progress in the schools, even with very poor kids. Rudy Crewe, the superintendent of schools in Miami, formerly chancellor in New York City, shows that if you take the lowest performing schools and put the person in charge of those schools, and then provide those schools with extra support, lower class size, incentives for teachers to work in those schools, you can actually move those schools and improve them over time. And that's happening in Miami today. There are fourth graders and eighth graders in Atlanta who are the highest performing students in the state of Georgia today. And not just at the KIPP schools, although the KIPP schools are right there at the top. There are schools in Montgomery County, Maryland, and Abington, Pennsylvania, that are showing that diversity need not be a weakness. That you can raise achievement for all in these districts by doing whatever it takes to provide support for your kids. And those are two districts that are showing that the gaps in achievement can close. And then there are places like Boston, New York, and Denver. And it's hard for me to even mention New York sometimes because, you know, Mike Bloomberg being one of the richest men in the world, it takes so much credit for having solved the problems in New York. And I often like to say, you know, New York has some of the best public schools and some of the worst still. And I'll give them credit because there are many excellent public schools. I'll describe some of those in a moment, and I have to acknowledge that there's been an environment created in New York City that allows good educators to be creative and produce schools that are worthy of any child. And you're seeing that now in New York. You're seeing it in Boston, in the pilot schools. And we're seeing it in places like Denver. So change is happening, change is real, change is moving forward, and it's showing us that it can be done. But it's not uniform. And we have to be as clear about what the obstacles are to further change if we're going to see more change in the right direction. There are also now a number of high-performing and high-poverty schools across the country. And again, the existence of those schools is a reminder that the problem is not the kids. And I say that frequently because too often when you go to schools and you talk about why certain kids are not performing, you invariably hear that the problem is those kids or their parents. How many of you have heard that? And every time I hear that, I know that's a school that will not improve, because if you blame the children and their parents, it means you're not accepting responsibility for what you do. If I took you to a place like PS 138 in the South Bronx, in the Marasania section of the South Bronx, I was there 3 months ago. All the kids come from the projects right next door. I was given a tour of the school by a fourth grader who takes me, so proud of the school, showing me the computer lab. The school is beautiful, artwork in the hall. We go through the school, she says, I'm going to take you to the second floor. It's a special part of the school. I said, what makes the second floor special? She said, on the second floor, we have the only museum on the history of the Bronx in our school. Do you have a museum in your school? Yes, we have a museum. People come and do tours of our school on a regular basis. And we go upstairs, and there are antiques on display. There's old clothing. There are artifacts. There are LPs made by groups that came from the Bronx, boxing tickets. And as we're walking by, I'm seeing all this stuff. I'm thinking to myself, it could all be vandalized. It could all be destroyed by children because it's all within reach. And then I asked the girl, I said, aren't they worried that kids will destroy this material that's out? And she looks at me like I'm some kind of sicko. She said, you know, we're really proud to have this here. Why would we destroy it? I know what school you went to. What's the contrast? The contrast is the middle school I went to in Oakland, California. Where I'm visiting a science classroom with no science equipment. And I asked the science teacher, where's the science equipment? She says, it's in the closet, locked up. I said, well, why is it locked up? She said, we keep it there so the kids won't break it. I said, do they ever get to use it? She says, only if they're good. You ever go to someone's house and they got their furniture covered? Waiting for those special guests to come over? A little bit like that science classroom. What's the difference between the kids at PS 138 and the kids at that middle school in Oakland? Is there something different about their culture or about the culture of the school? And the way they've come to appreciate and respect the environment that they learn within. I can take you to Portchester, New York, visit Edison Elementary School, a school that served where 95% of the kids come from homes where no one speaks English. All the kids, recent immigrants from the Caribbean. It's a high-performing school, has been for over 10 years now in the state of New York. At Portchester, they believe that you've got to educate the whole child, that you can't just focus narrowly on test scores, that you've got to address the health needs, the dental needs, the after-school needs, that you've got to engage the parents. If the parents can't speak English, you've got to provide classes for them too, so the school functions as a community center. And because lots of those kids are learning English, they don't have language specialists. Every teacher is a language specialist because they believe the only way those kids will become truly bilingual is if every teacher knows how to work and serve their language needs. So at Edison Elementary in Portchester, cultural difference is not a deficit. It's treated as an asset. Take you to PS 188. On the Lower East Side of Manhattan, where 20% of the kids served there are homeless. All the rest of the kids come from the projects next door, another high-performing, high-poverty school. And how do they do it, PS 188? They do it, again, by expanding their vision of what it takes to educate kids. So they've got an internet cafe that stays open until 9 at night. Why? Because they know that homeless children need a safe place to be, and that they can be placed in an environment where they get support and stimulated, that will also enhance their learning opportunities. They have art classes taught by real artists. Real artists, people who actually produce art, teaching their children, and novelists teaching kids writing, because they believe that they put kids in an enriched learning environment, that those kids will respond to the stimulation and support they receive. They don't do a narrow focus on test prep, but they do get high test scores. I could take you to Henshaw Middle School in Modesto, California, or Thurgood Marshall in Central Harlem, all, again, serving poor kids, all who believe that if you push kids to take challenging, rigorous courses, encourage them to challenge themselves, and you make sure that those courses are accessible and have the ability to support the needs of the students, that those kids can achieve at very high levels. So at Henshaw Middle School, they make sure that every student is in algebra by the eighth grade, because they've seen the research, and the research has shown us for a long time that algebra is the pathway to college. And who gets algebra when will determine who will go to college after graduation. But they know that at Henshaw, not every kid is ready for an intensive, rigorous algebra course in the eighth grade. So what do? Some kids get that course in a 50-minute period, and some kids get it in a 90-minute period. They don't lower the standard. They don't water it down. They just give them more time. And they eliminate homework. And why do they eliminate homework? Because they know homework is an equity issue. And if you don't have somebody at home to do the homework for you or with you, and if you don't have access to a computer, then your chances of being as successful are more limited. So at Henshaw and Thurgood Marshall, they show it is possible to push kids to achieve higher standards without watering those standards down, simply by finding ways to make those standards relevant and accessible to the children they serve. And then there are schools like Eagle Academy, an excellence charter school. Excellence is in Bed-Stuy. Both schools serve African-American males, and they serve African-American males because they've seen the data, and they know that African-American males are more likely to drop out, more likely to fail, more likely to end up in special ed, be expelled or suspended than any other group of students in school. So what are they doing? They are creating schools that deliberately and consciously challenge the stereotypes of those kids, because they know the research. They've seen the work by Claude Steele and Josh Aronson on the effects of stereotypes in the environment, on the ways in which the stereotypes will lead the kids to think less of themselves, challenge themselves less, believe that they can do basketball but not science, So what do they do with those schools? They deliberately expose kids to activities that break the stereotypes. So Eagle Academy is robotics. They have a top-tiered robotics team that competes nationally with other kids. And when you see these kids do the robotics, you see that they've got to do the physics and the math before they can build a robot. And when the arm doesn't do what it's supposed to do, they've got to go back to the drawing board, because this is applied science and math at work. I was a judge when they came to the Javits Center, 3,000 kids competing with their robots. That's when I encountered the kids from Eagle. They came in sixth place out of 68 teams. I had to give them the bad news. Sixth place wasn't good enough to make it to the finals. It's only the top three teams get to go to the Georgia Dome, where the finals takes place. And when I told them the news, they said, well, they still think sixth place is pretty good. We're happy. I said, well, tell me how you built the robot. And they explained they'd come in on weekends, and they put in after school, 10-hour days, working on this robot for over 3 months. They said the custodian helped them build the robot. So the custodian helped you. How did he help you? He said, he got his parts from all around school. Nobody knew where he got the parts from. Parts kept showing up from all over. And they had a science teacher who got paid nothing extra, who came in evenings, weekends with these kids. How do you get kids to invest their weekends on an activity like this? And at the end of watching them and hearing them explanations, I said, well, to these 17 boys, I said, you've come in sixth place. What's next? What are you guys going to do next? And every single one of these young men told me they want to become a mechanical engineer. And they think they can because they built that robot. Because Eagle Academy has created a school where it's cool to be smart. First question to you out there, and I got Sonny helping me, because I know you got these little devices. Is it cool for kids to be smart at your school? That makes you have to figure out who are the cool kids and are they smart? Say, why am I asking the question? I'm asking the question because here's the simple truth about education. We can't do it without the kids, can we? If the kids don't care about learning, if they're not invested in learning, if they don't come prepared, if they don't come ready to learn, then chances are, no matter what we do, it's not going to result in the kinds of learning and achievement that we're hoping for. So almost three quarters say, yes, it is. That's a good sign. All right. I'd like to hear more about those schools, hopefully after. What's the number one complaint we hear from kids about school today? Boring. That it's boring. And so I guess not speaking for those three quarters, that's a good sign. That's a teacher's opinion. But hopefully the teachers know what they're talking about. We have good research now on effective schools. And, you know, we've been studying effective schools for probably about 30 years also, although we don't learn that much from them. But nonetheless, they're out there and the data's coming. And I want to recommend a study by the Education Trust on high-performing, high-poverty schools called Dispelling the Myth. Came out in 2002. You can get it right from the website. One of the things that these effective schools do is they use data to monitor progress and to target reforms. They don't just change everything. They actually look, where do we need to make changes? And they study where they're achieving success, and they set benchmarks, and they evaluate. And they do that because they understand that faith-based reform is probably not good enough. You actually need evidence that you're making progress. In addition, they do assessment differently. Rather than assessing the kids in the spring and waiting for the results in the fall when you no longer have those kids, they assess them in the fall. And they continue to assess throughout the year, not with a battery of standardized tests, but by using the work that the kids produce to give feedback to teachers on the performance and how that performance compares to standards. Because when they do diagnostic assessment in that way, they're better able to monitor and to identify kids who are not making progress. In addition, they have shared leadership. Not one person who is doing a Herculean job. They've got leadership on second and third tier because schools are decentralized organizations. And no matter how good you are as a principal, one person cannot run the whole show. So the effective schools have people who are willing to step up. And when I say people, I don't only mean teachers. I mean the custodian. I mean the receptionist, because every member of the staff has an important role to play. And in the high-performing schools, they do. They've got a culture of high expectations for all, and as my colleague Richard Elmore says, they have internal accountability. And internal accountability is much more important than external accountability. Because when we feel accountable to each other, when there's clarity about what is expected of me and how what I do affects my colleagues, affects my students, affects the parents, that kind of mutual accountability is far more effective than being accountable to a superintendent or a board or a state that you probably don't see that often. In addition to what they do within school, they know a lot about what's happening to kids outside of school, about the pressures they face, about the challenges going on in their lives, because they need to know that in order to figure out what does it take to serve those kids. And I would say that as basic as that question might seem, what does it take to educate the children you serve? It's actually a very complex question. Because to answer the question, you actually have to know something about the kids you teach. What their lives are like when they're not with you. How they problem solve, how they use literacy. What the challenges are they face and their parents face. What their dreams are and hopes are. What excites them, what interests them. Because the more we know about our kids, the better chance we have of knowing how to educate them. I have a colleague, Kristen Luker, who's been studying teen pregnancy now for several years. The question she asked in her research is this: why do middle-class girls have fewer babies as teenagers than poor girls? And what she finds through her research is that the answer to the question is not really about sex, though sex is involved. The difference between the middle class girls and the poor girls is that the poor girls aren't going to college. If you think you're going to college, you think having a baby at 15 is a bad idea. If you're going nowhere, in your 15-year-old head, you can rationalize the decision to have a child, particularly if you come from a family where your mother had a baby as a teenager. When we know more about what's happening to our kids, what's going on in their lives, what's happening to their families, then we know what we've got to do as a school to meet the need. Because schools don't exist in a vacuum. And to the degree that we can tap into our communities and draw on partnerships with nonprofits, with local government, with businesses, with churches to support schools, then the mission of educating our kids becomes less burdensome. When you see schools that are helping kids to think concretely about the future, it's because they are trying to make up for what middle-class parents are already doing for their kids. When do middle-class parents start thinking about college for their kids?
Birth.
I asked my NYU students, when did your parents first start thinking about college for you? And one of them said, when the night they had sex, they started thinking about college. Why? Because they know they've got a plan. They can't leave anything to chance. They've literally got people, while they're pregnant, signing up for certain preschools. Can't leave anything for chance. When do parents who've never gone to college start thinking about college for their kids?
When their kids come to them,
when they're in the 12th grade, they have an information deficit. They don't understand how it works. They don't know about SATs. They don't know about financial aid. And in our typical schools, our typical high schools, too often, the counselor-to-student ratio is what? 200? 300? We were from California, but from California, California's 400, 500. Which means, are they doing much counseling? No, chances are they're mostly doing schedules. So who counsels? Who advises? All the research shows that when we advise and counsel and mentor our students, we can more significantly impact their outcomes. Read a book called Trust in Schools by Anthony Bright on how relationships with kids influences academic outcomes. Chances are the kids you have the most trouble with are the kids who are the most alienated and least connected to the adults in your school, which tells you a lot about what you need to do. At the highly effective schools, there is an understanding that the commitment to academic excellence and equity are not conflicting goals. They are the same goal, that are reconciled and that are worked on simultaneously. And why is that such an unusual thing? Because in most places, the opposite is true. In most places, anything that's done to promote equity is seen to come at the expense of excellence. And how do you know that? Because of the battles over tracking, because of the battles over any change that would seem to threaten the highest achieving kids. Because the high achieving kids tend to have parents who are watching closely what's going on, aren't they? Mm-hmm. And who have a strong sense of entitlement. And they're going to make sure that their kids do not get shortchanged by any reforms. And if anything happens that they don't like, they're going to let somebody know. And if they get no for an answer, they're going to go over their head, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Right to the superintendent, because they understand how to work the system. I was an elected school board member in Berkeley, California. I'm well acquainted with such parents. Who are the advocates in your schools for the kids whose parents are too busy or uninformed or don't speak the language or don't have time to get to the school? Who are their advocates? It is a conscious and deliberate policy in many districts and in many schools to assign the best teachers to teach the highest achieving kids and the least effective teachers to teach the neediest kids. Have you seen any research out there that shows you that this will ever work? I haven't seen any. Why does it happen? It happens because it's expedient to do so. It happens because sometimes the unions insist upon it. It happens because the parents of the high achievers won't let you get away with assigning anyone but a highly competent teacher to their kids. And it happens because the parents of the low achievers trust us. Mm-hmm. They just send their kids. Wish for the best. And unfortunately, too often, that trust is not well deserved. Because when there are no advocates, no guardians for equity within a school, kids get shortchanged. I was working with a district, an affluent district in New Jersey recently, did a workshop for principals there on the achievement gap, and I said that very often kids are being denied the opportunity to learn, and it's blatant and obvious, but no one is doing anything about it. People know it's happening. They know very well that the person assigned to teach the kids is not competent, but nothing is done about it. So they had a brand new principal there from the high school. He raised his hand and he said, "Well, I've seen something that sounds like what you're talking about." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, I've noticed that every day there is a group of African-American males who linger in the hallway after the bell rings. They take their time going to class. And no one bothers them. No one says anything. And for minutes, they'll be just lingering in the hallway." So I decided I was going to see what's going on with these kids. So I decided to talk with them and follow them to see where they were going. And I noticed that as I was there, they were all heading into the basement. I said, "Why are they going to the basement?" He said, "Well, that's what I wanted to know. Why would they go to the basement?" And then I discovered they go to the basement because that's where the special ed classes are held. And the reason why they take their time going there is because they're embarrassed to be seen going to the basement because everybody knows that's where the dumb kids are. He says, "You think we need to get them out of the basement?" Knowing full well that every single person in the room who had been there longer knew those kids were in the basement. My question to you is this: who's in your basement? Who's in the bungalow out back? Who's in the classroom with the teacher you know very well cannot meet the needs of the kids? Because too often it's obvious. It's clear. But what's not clear is why nothing is done about it. Why no action is taken. In the high-performing schools, there is a clear sense that we're not just preparing kids for tests or for college, we're preparing them for life. And when you're preparing kids for life, when you're preparing them to become responsible adults, and you know that some of those kids are not white and middle class, you know that those kids have to become bicultural. They have to become bicultural because if they can't speak standard English, if they don't know when it's time to pull up their pants or take the hood off their head, they will find opportunities denied to them, even if they've got good scores. Because we live in a society where kids are judged based upon how they look, how they act, how they speak. Lisa Delpit calls these the codes of power. And if you don't have a command over the codes of power, you find opportunities denied. And they might tell you, I'm denying you this job because you can't speak standard English, or because that dress is too short, or your pants are falling down to your knees. They just say, thank you, have a nice day. These are life skills that are vital for success in this country. But the only way they can be taught is if the adults who are teaching the kids care enough about them to let them know what these codes are, that they've got to be able to code switch. That the way you talk with your friends is not the way you talk to an employer or a police officer. And those kinds of skills are typically not on a standardized test, are they? But if you don't learn them, you find that your options are limited. So there's a lot we know about high-performing schools, because they're out there. And I like to remind people they're out there even for kids who are coming from families that are struggling to get by. Because the truth is that how much you earn or your race does not determine how much you can do. And we have lots and lots of good evidence of that. What gets in the way of us achieving these schools on a much grander scale, so they're not the exception? Well, I would say too often we are stuck in practices that prevent us from truly educating all of our kids at high levels. And I've mentioned one already, is that tendency to blame kids, blame parents. That tendency results in what I call the normalization of failure, a complacency about the patterns, because you don't think it's your job, your responsibility. A very pervasive problem. But an even more pervasive problem is what I see as the tendency, particularly in high schools, to see teaching and learning as disconnected activities. Teaching is something we do to kids. Learning is something they do in response. Too many of our high school teachers confuse teaching with talking. Teaching and talking are not the same, are they? When I was a brand new teacher in Providence, Rhode Island, teaching American history, my mentor teacher told me my job was to get the kids from the Revolution in September to Vietnam in June. He said, here's that the job, here's the book, go to it, I'll be in the back drinking coffee. I said, wait a second, what about the Constitution? Isn't the Constitution important? He said, oh, no, don't get caught up in the Constitution. You got to get to Vietnam. I said, what about the Civil War? He said, listen, I'm telling you, you get caught up in the Civil War, you won't get to the Vietnam War. You've got to get through all these chapters. It was very clear to me that what he intended was not that these kids master American history, understand the concepts so they come away better prepared for citizenship, but that we get through a book. Not the same, is it, as teaching? Talk to your kids. Ask them how many could say they took chemistry, they took American history, they took Shakespeare. How much do they remember? How much do they retain? What do they know now as a result of taking these classes that appear in their transcripts? When teachers teach in ways that are disconnected from learning, they think their job is to cover the material instead of asking for evidence of whether or not the material is being learned. There are certain teachers, by virtue of what they teach, who understand the difference and teach differently already. The art teachers, the theater teachers, the music teachers, the voc ed teachers, the coaches, all teach differently because they're focused on performance. And when you're focused on performance, then you are actively involved in seeing to it that your kids actually get better with time. And you don't think that explaining is good enough. or saying it louder is an effective intervention. The best teachers don't expect kids to learn the way they teach. The best teachers teach the way kids learn. When you teach the way kids learn, you know what we call that now? We call that differentiated instruction. Because the only way you can differentiate if you understand that not all kids learn the same ways. And teachers who learn teach the way kids learn are constantly modifying, they are constantly tailoring, because increasingly the best schools personalize learning for kids and monitor and assess in a very individualized manner. And yes, that takes much more work, but I would argue that's the way to the future if we're going to ensure we're educating all our kids. I could take you right now to Mission Hill Pilot School, a K-8 school in Boston, and you will find every single child has a modified IEP. They monitor every single learner, and so anytime a parent goes in to ask, how is my child doing, they can look in that CUNY file and let them know exactly how that child is doing, because they are assessing and monitoring and tailoring all the time. So if you want to make sure that your high school's changed, that you're not losing kids, you've got to address this issue of connecting teaching and learning. If you're at a school where you're seeing kids continue to be grouped together on the basis of ability or behavior, you're probably in a school that's not going to make much progress. We've known for a long time that when you round up all the kids who are behind and assign a slow teacher, you get slower kids. It never works. But that pattern, that tendency is always there, isn't it? It's always there. In fact, that's one of the reasons why special education is often not the reform it was intended to be. If special education worked the way it should, we should all want our kids in special ed, shouldn't we? Because special education is based on the idea that we're going to diagnose the learning needs and develop a plan to meet the need for that child. But in most schools, the longer the child's been categorized, the further behind they fall. Why? Because of grouping, because of the self-fulfilling prophecy, because of the stigma of being a slow learner, a stigma that invariably results in the child believing that they are slow. And a child who sees themselves as slow is going to be a tough child to teach. So we've got to do less of that. We've got to do more to address the morale of our staff, because I have never been to a high-performing schools where people are not working hard, taking up their own time, weekends, evenings, to come in, to make their classrooms look beautiful, to plan their lessons, to call parents. And they do that not because the contract requires it. I've never seen a contract make people work hard. But I have been to schools where people feel good about working hard because of the culture that's been created that's reinforcing. So there's a collective spirit of common working together to achieve common goals. And again, that's about culture, that's about morale, that's about finding ways to recognize and treat people with dignity and respect. Because here's the big obstacle in public education. Compensation for teachers is not connected to performance. You get paid the same if you give your heart or if you give the bare minimum. And that's a major obstacle. Because for a long time, we relied on people just to care, just to give themselves, and for sometimes it worked, but in too many cases it didn't work, and that's the reason, part of the reason we have such unevenness in teaching in our schools. We've got to find ways to tap into the desire of all teachers to make a difference, which is usually what brings people into teaching, and not the great salaries. Certainly that will keep them there. We've got to stop treating parents as though they're irrelevant, as though they are a problem, an obstacle, particularly if they are not educated, particularly if they don't speak the language or don't understand all the terms we use. Everybody always says, oh yeah, parents matter, parents matter. My question to the schools is, what are you doing to enlist parents as partners? It is very rare to meet a high-performing student that does not have considerable parent support. And the good news is this. The The vast majority of parents want to see their kids succeed, don't they? Yes, they do. Even parents with drug problems, ask them. They want to see their kids succeed. They want them to succeed too. They take care of them when they get older. It doesn't mean they know what to do to help their child succeed. But the fact that they want their kids to succeed means there's an opportunity to create the partnership, to enlist those parents to support their kids, and all kids, regardless of their backgrounds, can help. All parents can help their kids. I come from a family where neither of my parents graduated from high school. They sent all six of my brothers and sisters to the best colleges in the country. We are living proof that your background should not determine how much you can accomplish academically. How many of you come from a family where neither of your parents graduated from college? Look around the room. Over half the people here today. How many come from a family neither parent graduated high school? Still some hands. Now ask yourself this question. When you look in your school, in your gifted classes, in your honors classes, will you find kids from various backgrounds there? Kids like yourselves, kids who come from families that are struggling to get by, where the parents are not highly educated. If you don't, it raises very serious questions about what we're doing with children. Because the talent's out there. Too many of our schools still adopt rules and procedures that are at odds with our educational goals. And we have to ask, why would any school do that? Well, when it comes to discipline, I see so many examples over and over again where this is still the case. I was at a school in Cleveland recently. They were about to suspend an eighth grader for truancy. I'm glad you laughed. It means you get it. And he said, they were going to be 3 days. He said, give me 5 days. I need 5 days. And the assistant principal was going to oblige him. He said, I'll give you the 5. Because his strategy was not to use suspension to change behavior. His goal was to get rid of a kid who was a thorn in his side. Put him out on the streets. Send him home. In most of our schools, we rely on two strategies to discipline kids. We start with humiliation, and we work our way to exclusion. If the goal of discipline is to change behavior, to do what Lawrence Kohlberg said. Lawrence Kohlberg, the psychologist at Harvard, wrote a lot about moral development in children, said the goal of discipline is not to teach kids to do what's right in order to avoid punishment. The goal of discipline is to teach kids to do what's right even when we're not looking. Humiliation and exclusion don't do that. We disproportionately punish the kids with the greatest needs. And we too often punish them because of their needs. If a kid is acting out because they can't read and they're embarrassed during reading time, then sending them to the front office is probably not going to solve the problem, is it? And if a kid is acting out because they're abused or neglected at home, then sending them home is probably not going to solve that problem either. And I'm not going to say that any of this is simple or easy, because we're dealing with children who are coming from families in distress, families that are not able to support their own children, and so increasingly schools are taking on jobs that used to be the job of the family. So I understand this is not easy to do. But I also know that if we don't have a strategy to reconnect kids to learning, if we don't have a strategy to get at the roots of the behavior problem, and if we don't have a strategy that addresses the moral and ethical foundation of discipline, we will never solve this problem. When I go to high-performing schools where there are not guards and metal detectors and discipline is not an issue, it's not because the kids are intimidated. It's because of the culture that's been created within the school, and the kids understand their role a lot like that student at PS 138 that I mentioned before. I would also say that when I go to such schools, I find lots of adults who have this very ambiguous quality called moral authority. And moral authority is not rooted in your title or your position, it's rooted in the relationship. It's the relationship you have with kids that lets the kids know because of who you are, because of what you represent, because of the relationship you establish with them, that you are a person that must be respected. And in fact, you're going to respect them as well. And that's such a nebulous concept. It's so hard to teach, but it's so vital. If you're in a school where you don't have adults with moral authority, you probably have adults who are either afraid of kids or who simply don't like them and don't want to get that close to them. I was working with another school in Oakland, California. Brand new teacher from Teach for America. Are you familiar with Teach for America? Typical profile, smart, young, idealistic, coming out of an elitist school, or elite school, not elite. Teaching elitist schools. But she's struggling. She comes to me and she says, you know, I'm having trouble with classroom management. No one's been willing to help me. Could you come and give me some pointers? So I'm struck by her troubles. I said, I'll be happy to come sit in your class. I go to the class and I sit in. After a few minutes, it's clear that this problem is far worse than she described. The classroom is totally out of control. Kids are screaming. She's screaming. It's total chaos in the room. No learning going on at all. Painful to sit through. Wait till the end of the period. She says, will you see what I'm talking about? I said, yes, I see. This is really bad. She said, well, I can't take it anymore. I'm going to quit. It's March. I said, well, before you quit, let's go see the principal together. We go see the principal. She explains what's going on in the classroom, and I'm listening. And then when she's finished, the principal says to her, you're a professional. Deal with it. Then I speak up. And I say, listen, if you don't help her, she's going to quit. If she quits, you'll have to get a sub for the rest of the year. So that gets his attention. He says, I don't want that. He says, I have an idea. So we have a veteran teacher from the school who's just retired. She's available now as a substitute. I'm going to ask you to come back and take over your classroom for a couple days. I can only afford a couple days, but I think you'll learn something from her. Watch her. She's great with kids. So both the new teacher and I think it's a good idea, only idea that made any sense so far. So we go back, and the next day, the veteran teacher shows up. And there's something about her walk. Something about the look she gives. But the kids can tell right away the real thing is here today. So kids who had been out of control are suddenly they're on task. She's teaching some math class. She's teaching the material. The kids are working. No problems. New teacher and I are both shocked at how dramatic the change is in this classroom. At one point during the lesson, she sees two girls talking. So she stops what she's doing. She turns and she says, young lady, when I'm speaking, I want you to be quiet. She turns to go back to the board, and under her breath, the girl says, bitch. But not a direct bitch. Indirect, you know the difference? It was way down. Down there. I didn't pretend it was a fart or a sneeze. The kind of comment you could just let slide if you wanted to. Except it's a veteran teacher. So she turns to the girl and she says, young lady, do I look like your mother? And the girl reacts like that. No, you don't look like my mother. He said, whenever you speak to me, I want you to think of your mother. And she goes back to the lesson. Girl goes back to work. Class does not miss a beat. New teacher turns to me and says, how did she know that that would work? How did she know the girl would respond that way? My question to you, what does the veteran teacher know that the new teacher doesn't? Can you guys do open-ended questions? Yeah, you can. So let's do that as a poll to the group. What does the veteran teacher know that the new teacher doesn't? It's a test, right? All the kids are watching, and the kids know she's not as tough as we thought. So bitches are coming out all over now, right?
Yeah.
She doesn't call for help. Why doesn't she call a dean? Because she knows if she lets that slide, then that undermines her authority with these kids. She knows there must be a rule against bitch calling up there, right? No school in the country where you can call a teacher a name like that. Why doesn't she cite the rules? That's the most telling, isn't it? Because she knows something that the new teacher doesn't, which is the kids know better. The kids know they're not supposed to curse at teachers. What they don't know is that there's an adult in the room that won't allow it to occur. They actually feel comforted knowing that there's finally a responsible adult who's going to stop the kids from acting like fools. The kids want that. They actually want someone to tell both of your parents, be quiet, do your work. Not to berate and to belittle, but to maintain an atmosphere where they can learn. And she also knows that if she can keep them engaged in learning math, she'll have fewer problems in the first place. Because ultimately, the best teachers who have the fewest disruptions have found a way to keep the kids intellectually engaged. We have a shortage of teachers out there who have those kinds of skills. And guess what? You don't learn those skills in grad school, too. No, you learn them on the job. So one of the things we've got to do is we've got to start doing more of what we know works. What works is extended learning time. Not more of the same. Some people are calling for a longer school day. Longer school day, I don't endorse, but more of the robotics, more of the chess, more learning opportunities after school can deepen the learning. And our research on extended learning time is very good. We need to find ways to get kids connected to school through extracurricular activities. Kids who are involved in sports, in music, in theater do better than kids who are not involved. Research is very strong on this. Kids who don't have supportive parents at home need a mentor, need some adult in school that they know has their back, that they can turn to for advice and support. Schools that are doing that are making a huge difference. Schools that are identifying kids early that are not making progress, that are intervening early, that are doing good diagnostic work to figure out why the kids are not making progress, are also getting very different outcomes. Schools that are pushing kids to take challenging, rigorous courses are making a big difference. And finally, schools that are doing ongoing professional development teachers in all three areas, content, pedagogy, and relationship building are making a difference. Because teaching has to be a lifelong learning profession. We need a new paradigm to do this. The old paradigm won't allow us to create the schools we need. And the problem is that most of us were educated under the old paradigm. The old paradigm led us to believe that intelligence was in the genes. It was biologically determined. And if you believe it's biologically determined, then you believe the job of schools is to measure intelligence and to sort accordingly. And many of our schools are still focused on measuring and sorting. Under the old paradigm, we gave the most to the kids who we thought had the most potential and the least to the kids who we thought had the least potential. We used discipline to weed out kids. We let our organization and our schedule determine what was possible with kids. So we need a different way of thinking about students, thinking about school and learning. One that focuses on cultivating talent in all kids, which means we've got to do more to understand the strengths, the potential of children, particularly children in poverty. We need to be as attentive to the social and emotional needs of children as we are to their academic needs. The research on social and emotional intelligence is very strong. These kinds of skills are lifelong skills that benefit an individual throughout their adult life. We know that learning another language and developing creativity and cultivating the imagination are also important because the fastest growing industries, in fact, the only industries in the economy, read the Wall Street Journal today, the only sector of the economy that's not in recession is the creative sector, the high-tech sector. We need a paradigm shift that allows us to create schools that cultivate talent and creativity and imagination in children. And we need an organization and a schedule that's consistent with those priorities. Creating this kind of school involves much more focus on the culture of our schools. A culture that fosters collaboration, that fosters reciprocity and learning, that fosters an atmosphere where we deliberate over what's important, ask tough questions of each other and of ourselves. A culture that enlists our parents to be our partners in the process of educating their children. I have a lot of optimism about education today because I get to go to schools where I see the changes being made. I know it can be done because it is being done. My message to you is this: push the margins, ask the tough questions,
Don't settle. Don't accept the idea that certain kids won't perform because of their backgrounds. Challenge your colleagues to think differently about what they do and to ask different questions of themselves. And be willing to imagine new ways of educating our children. We are a nation at risk. Our democracy is at risk. When we don't educate our children well, we set ourselves up for tyranny. We are a nation at war. We are in a nation that now has over 2 million adults behind bars. Every dollar we spend to incarcerate is a dollar we don't have for education, for health care, or for any other need. There's not a politician from any party who will tell you we have too many people in prison. I was recently on a panel in Colorado, and I said we need preschool for kids, we need after school, we need health care. And the person interviewing me said, well, how are we going to pay for these things? I said, well, there's only one way to pay for it in the short term, and that's to take the money from the prison budget. Because over half the people in prison are there for drug-related nonviolent crimes anyway, so they should be in rehab. I said, but there's no politician that'll do this. And I was followed on stage by the governor of Colorado, and he said, Professor's right, I agree with him, that's what needs to happen. I'm a former prosecutor, that's exactly what we need to do. And I applauded, I gave a standing ovation, I said, this guy is great. And I thought he was at the end of his term. Amazing how you get that courage, right when it's time to leave. We need the courage to come from lots of others out there. We can't wait till we get the right governor or the right president. We gotta make it happen now, because we have a lot at stake. What's at stake is our future. And as you think about how to create the schools of the future, I encourage you to make sure that we don't leave any of our children behind. Thank you.